So I've got something exciting to share. My book, What Are You Thirsty For? Rethinking Alcohol and the Life You Want, is now available for pre-order. It's about rethinking your drinking, not because you necessarily have to, but because deep down you know there's more waiting on the other side. It's about creating space for clarity, for calm, and the version of you that doesn't need alcohol to cope. So if you're looking for a refreshing take on alcohol identity and desire, just tap the link in the show notes and pre-order. Right, let's get on with the episode. Welcome to the Big Drink Rethink, the podcast for anyone questioning their relationship with alcohol or simply wondering what more life might hold. I'm Anna Donaghy, alcohol mindset coach, author, and former strategist. And each episode is going to blend lived experience, psychological insight, and powerful tools to help you understand your habits and gently rethink your drinking in a way that throws open oodles of possibilities. So whether you're trying to quit, cut down, or you're just plain curious, then you are in the right place. Let's rethink things together and explore what you're really thirsty for. So hello and welcome back to the Big Drink Rethink, where today I am thrilled to be joined in the studio by the lovely Luke Jones. Luke is a sober transformation coach based on the Isle of Man, and he is dedicated to helping dads quit drinking and become stronger role models for their families without, and this is really important, without sacrificing any fun or connection. So Luke is an ICF accredited life coach and an NLP master practitioner. So he's got all the credentials, and he draws from one of the greatest credentials of all, really, which is his personal journey of overcoming alcohol and regaining presence in his own family life. And I really wanted to talk to Luke today because, quite frankly, his personal story breaks the dated but all too often upheld stereotype of what it means to be a man. And he's a great example of how resisting those cultural norms and releasing old expectations can open up a way of life that's built on much more presence and freedom. So welcome to the studio, Luke.
Thank you very much, Anna. That was a hell of an intro. Thank you very much.
Was it? I work hard on my intros. I do. But actually, I always then do say, is there anything you want to add? Did I leave anything out?
No, that was a hell of an intro.
Or happy. Cool. Okay. Well, I'll leave you to do a bit more of an intro, actually, because what I'm going to do is say, before we leap into the dynamics and into the core of the conversation, I'd love listeners to understand and learn a little bit more about your journey. And of course, you know, I guess I'm talking about your story, how you've come to be a coach, and I guess your drinking career leading up to that point.
Okay. So I am originally from Bristol in the West Country. You can probably tell from the accent. And back in the day, grew up in the 90s. Obviously, the 90s have got a lot to answer for, I feel. My first memory of drinking was drinking a bottle of cider in a field, typically in the West Country, about the age of 14, 15.
Snap.
Yeah. I think it was a bottle of White Lightning or Diamond White, you know, one of those. Mm-hmm. And I did it to fit in with the group, to have confidence, as many of we do, you know, many of us do. We're tribal animals, aren't we? I think creatures. So
absolutely.
And I think back in the day, it served a purpose. You know, it was the way that we connected. It was the way that it was just something that we did back then. And I definitely, as my drinking career progressed, I think back then I used it only in social situations, but it just got more and more predominant as I got older. So when I left school, I went backpacking. And my drinking really did start to take off then. I traveled around Australia, Southeast Asia, South America. There was obviously a big party scene in the backpacking community. And in South America, we started to do some drugs and stuff as well. So that all came into it. Mm. And then I come back from backpacking in my early 20s and met my wife and started a family. And along with that came more and more responsibility. So I think my drinking really, really started to take off then. I started drinking more and more on my own. I used to use the phrase, you know, I've earned it. I've worked really, really hard. That old chestnut. And it just got predominantly worse and worse and worse. Like I said, back in the day, it served a purpose, but I felt like I was becoming more and more misaligned. I was drinking for the wrong reasons. And a couple of things that I can remember, we used to go out drinking with family, and we'd be at a bonfire night, for example, and I'd have cans actually inside my coat. And family members would be making a few comments. They'd be saying, God, Luke, any excuse with you, isn't it? And, yeah. You know, all these little things were happening, Anna. And I just laughed it off and just thought, you know, this is what dads do to cope. Obviously, there's a lot of self-medicating going on there as well. And I remember the day trips out with the family always used to revolve around going to a pub on the way home. We'd go to family events. I remember not long ago being at a gymnastics show with my daughter. And the first thing I said to my wife when we got there was, oh, where's the bar? You know, where can I get a drink? Instead of having a coffee, I would always want an alcoholic drink. It's just little things.
It's a classic story of things just begin to revolve around alcohol, don't they? Even when you're sort of structuring a day that is technically, for all intents and purposes, supposed to be revolving around something else, like, you know, a horse competition or a riding competition or something like that. It's just a way of sort of shoehorning stuff in. Yeah, even, you know, just making sure that it features at some point. Can I just ask you, just risk of interrupting you, a couple of things I just wanted to sort of pick up on. You said that you started to feel misaligned. Misaligned from what? What was the, where was that sense of sort of wonkiness coming in?
So when I say misaligned, I felt like drink was holding me back. Okay. I felt like when I got to 40, especially, I got to 40 and I just remember waking up one day, a bit of a midlife crisis. And I just thought, is this it? Am I really just going to keep on doing the same things, that's being stuck in the same old patterns? Hungover one morning, the kids jumping on the bed and I just didn't have any energy. And I'm just thinking, is this it? Am I going to go another 40 years like this? And I felt like there was so much potential that I wasn't living up to. I felt like I could give so much more. And I just felt misaligned. So from then I went on a bit of a personal development journey. And that's how I eventually got into coaching, did my ICF accredited life coaching course. And then I become an NLP practitioner as well. But it all stemmed from, I remember it clear as day, waking up at one morning. I'm thinking, is this it? You know, and one of the big things for me as well was when I used to, obviously I coach dads now as well. So I think a lot of this wanting to change, Anna, as well, revolves around your why. It's such a big thing. I know it gets banded around a lot in the coaching industry, but you need to have a strong why. And that's what I tie, you know, being a dad, being a good role model, setting a good example revolves around. So a couple of examples with my own son was, I remember one day him bringing, I used to get him to bring me beer, cans of lager. And I remember I said, Max, go and grab us a can from the fridge or whatever. And he'd bring it over. And I remember taking it off him and saying, oh, this is why you have kids. And in that moment, just the way he looked at me, I thought, oh my God, what have I just said? You know, so all these, I was getting all these signs. And then one day I went to the fridge and I opened up the fridge, grabbed a can off the top shelf. And I remember shutting the door and he just stared at me and he said, Dad, are you an alcoholic? And I was just like, oh God, wow. Yeah.
One
of those moments, yeah. So I was always a grey area drinker. I never had a real rock bottom, but for me, that was a rock bottom.
I get it.
Yeah, definitely.
I think I've said a few times on this podcast that my own rock bottom, and everyone's is different, was, you know, yes, when the kids started to notice, And, you know, questions like that, or why is mummy slurring her words? And, you know, why is mummy speaking funny? And yeah, I mean, it's scaring the kids, you know.
Exactly.
Just rewinding though, because we're going to talk about that moment when you just decided that you wanted to sort of carve out a different type of future, you know, make sure the next 40 years didn't look the same. When you say, you know, just drinking to cope, part of being a dad, are we talking all the kind of usuals, tiredness, pressure, responsibility? Oh my God, I'm responsible for two, you know, little human beings. Are we talking about, you know, juggling life's stuff? What were you sort of consciously aware that you were drinking for or drinking at?
Okay, so a couple of things there. The first being, I've got quite an active brain, so mm-hmm. I just remember that it's a quick fix, essentially, isn't it? And it is a form of escapism, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So I've got quite a buzzy brain, ADHD brain, or whatever, however you want to frame it. But I don't like labels, but I think I used to do it to switch off because it was that instant fix. Obviously, now with what I do with coaching, I've got loads of different coping mechanisms, and I've got a toolkit that I use for NLP for coping with cravings and urges. But back then it was just so easy to grab that can and switch off. So I think that was a big thing for me, having a stressful day and constantly justifying my actions by saying, I deserve it. I work hard. I'm the man of the house. I've got that responsibility. I'm the breadwinner. So all of these things seep in, and you're constantly, you know, validating yourself, giving yourself permission to drink. And obviously it was such a bad habit for me, and it wasn't in alignment with that future version of myself that I wanted to become.
Yeah, I find that really interesting, because of course, you know, what you're saying there is the stories that you're telling yourself that basically kept in your drinking was, you know, I deserve this, I'm the man of the house, I'm responsible, you know, this is what part of being a dad is all about. Yeah.
Exactly.
And did you at the same time have a kind of a social life that was very boozy? I know you said you started to sort of drink on your own and sort of shift gear with your drinking. But did you also, were you part of like a blokey group, or sort of, you know, a social group that was quite male dominated and drinking focused?
Yes. So I'm a plumber by trade. Right. So I've grew up in a very boozy culture. My first job as a plumber, I remember we were always in the pub every Friday, and a lot of my colleagues were even in the pub on lunchtimes during the day. So it's always been there. And I think especially for men, I coach men and fathers, but with men, I've spoke with many friends about this as well, obviously, since becoming a coach. The first thing you say when you go out as a group of lads is, what pub are we going to? It's the go-to thing, right? Mm. So, and obviously, if you say to one of your mates that you want to go out for a coffee, they might look at you a bit funny.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the norm. And I've spoken about this endlessly with my wife. And if she wants to go out and see her friends, they might go out shopping, they might go out for a coffee. Whereas with men, it's very, very, it's so deeply embedded in our culture and society, isn't it, to go down the pub. Mm. And if you can't keep up with the lads, if you can't have a real drink, then there's something wrong with you, and you get pushed away, be called all sorts of names. And this is what holds so many dads back that I coach, Anna, that it's the fear of the unknown, and it's that limiting belief in their head that they are going to be excluded from the group, and they're going to lose a lot of friends.
Yeah,
definitely. It's a massive thing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, it's massive. It's absolutely massive. I mean, a couple of things on that. I mean, you know, if you're part of a group and you fear losing that connection, then that can feel like literally a matter of life or death. It literally can, because, you know, for years and years and years up until that point, they have been your life, your social group, your not just part of who you are, but a very significant part of what you do. And there's this, I'm going to do a podcast on it, you know, with regards to sort of the whole connection piece. that is, you know, you can feel the fear of rejection, can feel like physical pain, physical pain. It's very, very real. And you know, it's not in your head. It's not like, oh no, it's, you know, it is literally, it's very real. And secondly, the way the human brain is wired is we fear loss. We fear loss so much more with so much more strength. So I think, you know, this is sort of this idea of loss aversion of, you know, I'm scared of losing what I already have is twice as strong as the feeling of joy of gaining something new. So, you know, it's the loss of something you already have, which is what keeps us stuck. And if we all have assumptions that our friends are going to ditch us and, you know, stop asking us out and stuff like that, then it does. It keeps us well and truly stuck. It sounds like, you know, there was a sort of a stereotypical sort of dynamics going on, you know, tradesmen out for drinks. That was your kind of, so you wake up one morning and you're like, oh my God, is this what the next 40 years looks like? I don't want this to be what the next 40 years looks like, presumably. And then the fear. So what did you think? I mean, you're sitting there on the one hand saying, I want this different future. But on the other hand, you're going, how the hell and what the hell? And, you know, who the hell am I going to hang out with? Who am I going to be? So talk me through that and all the conflicting thoughts that are going on at that point.
Yeah. So I remember as I started my personal development journey, I started journaling. It's one of the first things of, you know, meditation, journaling, all these sorts of things, all these habits. I started creating a morning routine. And when I started journaling and listing all the pros and cons of drinking, obviously the pros start outweighing the cons. So I thought I'd do a couple of tests. So big rugby fan, I love the rugby. So I went to the rugby at Twickenham and I took the family. And I remember telling my wife, I said, right, I'm going to drive. And she said, what, you're going to drive to the rugby? We always used to go up to Twickenham when we lived in Bristol. When we were on the train, we were drinking on the train, as you can imagine.
Yep.
Of course, that's what we do. And I just remember, Anna, I never used to remember any of the games. I didn't even remember what happened on the day. I was so drunk. So I drove up with the kids and it was an absolutely brilliant day. We had a really, really good day. And I just remember coming, and I remembered every kick of the game. I remember the score. And I remember coming home and saying to the wife, I said, I can't believe it. That was a bit of proof, a bit of evidence that I could actually have fun and have a good time without alcohol. So I was slowly building this proof that there was, because again, that's a massive limiting belief of many of my friends now. They say, you know, you can't have fun without alcohol. Whenever you go out to have fun, it's got to be revolve around drink. Mm-hmm. Even if you do a social activity straight down the pub after, you've got to have a drink, right? So it was about building evidence that I could have a good time, obviously without the booze. And all of these little niggling things, all these other signs I was getting, I knew it was having a negative effect on being the good role model and setting the good example that essentially I wanted to do for my kids. And I really wanted to prove to my kids that you can change is possible, and you can have a good time without alcohol. You don't need this drug in your system to have a good time. And then that just manifested and built really. So, yeah, and it just snowballed from there, Anna.
I think it's what I find interesting as well about, and I know it might just be terminology, you might use it interchangeably, but it's interesting to me that you're saying when you started your personal development journey as opposed to when I decided to quit alcohol. Because there's a real difference in there. One is about removing something from your life and saying this has got to go, and the other one is about saying I want to grow. Mm-hmm. I want to grow. So there's a sort of, I want to gain. I want to develop. And I'm really passionate about personal development. I think it's something that you do actually get really more and more passionate about when you give up alcohol, because you create the space, and the whole process is about discovering new stuff about yourself that you then think, well, I want to capitalize on that, or I've got more energy, I've got more clarity, I know where I want to focus. And it just strikes me that, you know, when we're younger, all the way through school, all the way through university, if that's what people choose to do, certainly all the way through sort of professional exams and stuff like that, growth kind of happened to you. it was automatic. You know, you sort of, you didn't just grow physically, you know, month by month, but you grew throughout your school education, and it was very structured. And then you get to this point in life and you just stop. And unless you pick up the reins yourself, unless you start doing stuff, you just stop. And that's how I kind of woke up when I decided I wanted to sort of, well, I needed to give up alcohol. I had to get that out of the way. But my next thing was, when did this stagnation actually start? You know, because that is exactly, you know, that's what had happened to me. I'd literally drunk myself to a standstill and lost an interest in everything. So I think it's interesting that you just, you know, you didn't just think, I'm going to quit alcohol. You thought straight off the bat, I want to sort of go on a bit of a journey. I want to develop myself. So you did your accreditations, you did your training, you did your coaching certifications. What else opened up for you? What happened? What was the sort of journey for you there? Did you find it easy to stop?
Did I find it easy to stop? No, definitely not. No. I'm not, but I was never, like I said, I don't like labels, but I was never an alcoholic, but I never, it was those habits that they're so deeply embedded in your subconscious, decades and decades. And when I speak with clients, it's the identity shift that they really, really struggle with. Even though they know that old version of themselves isn't serving them anymore and serving them and their family, and they want to move on, their brain, their amygdala, that part of the brain wants to hold on to it so passionately, doesn't it, as you know yourself. And you've got to just let go, and it's so hard, isn't it, Anna?
No, it's massive. I mean, if
it's so difficult.
I mean, if drinking has become every, you know, it's been part of every social event, every celebration, every rugby weekend in the rugby season, every moment of stress relief, then the idea of stepping away from it is, it's like losing a part of yourself. It literally is, and it can feel like that. I think the reality is different, but it's when that drinking has become so entwined, yeah, you know, with your identity, that the thought of change isn't really just about a habit anymore. It's about self-definition, and it's that sort of, if I'm not a drinker, if I'm not, you know, Luke the drinker, then who am I? Who is Luke? You know, but the brilliant thing that I always say is, you can be who you want to be. That's the point. Once you stop handicapping any form of development by, you know, drinking, once you give yourself the chance to sort of say, well, you know, what do I want to be? And who said that learning has to stop at the age of 18 or 21 if you go to uni or whatever? Who said that this is it? Who said? You know, I didn't sign up. I'm not the finished deal. But it's all in the narratives. It's all in the narratives that we say to, you know, that narrative that I'm a rugger bugger and that I must drink when I go on the train from Bristol up to Twickenham, because that's what rugby fans do. It's a narrative, it's a script.
Exactly.
It's one that so many people follow that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, but it's not, you know, it's not who you are. It's just what you've done in the past. You can do different. So
yeah, that's it. Yeah, I mean, that whole self-development journey that you were saying about, Anna, as I started doing it, I started to listen to lots of podcasts like this one and lots of other sober ones. I started reading all these audio books, and then I started learning, and literally it's self-awareness and then education, isn't it? So I was listening to all these audio books and great podcasts, and I started learning about REM sleep, read the amazing book by William Porter. That was a big one for me.
Yeah,
and when I learned about that, and I had so many aha moments where I was like, that's why I wake up in the morning most mornings at 3 o'clock with my heart beating out of my chest.
Yeah,
you know, all these little things were all these seeds were being planted, and then I got a smartwatch and started recording my REM sleep. And my heart rate variability was always so high. It was like I was ill all the time, and it was always when I was drinking. So, yeah, as my personal development, as I wanted to become this different person, alcohol was no longer serving me. And I think when you do cut the booze out and you really find yourself, as corny, as cliche as it sounds, when you become the best version of yourself, you don't need to escape. And that is why you don't need alcohol. And that's what I truly believe. That's what I tell all of my clients. So it's all about finding out who you really are and just be willing to go on that journey, sit in the delayed gratification. Because I always say to everyone, whatever you've accomplished in life, anything that's really, really good in life, in my opinion, you've got to work hard for. You know, nothing's easy. You know, so
I got that, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Yeah, I know. We're pleasure seeking creatures, aren't we? I heard a great quote about happiness. There's two ways to be happy, either through pleasure or through being fulfilled. And it's so, so true. If we keep on seeking pleasure short term, it's going to be short lived and it's not going to serve us. If we chase fulfillment and we just accept that we've got to sit with delayed gratification and we've got to work hard and we've got to put the time in, on the other side of all that hard work is a completely different different life. But it's so, so hard. I know, Anna.
But it starts with a commitment, doesn't it? And I think the thing is, you know, you talk about the why. You mentioned, you know, a few minutes ago, you talked about the why. It's so important. And I think the distinction, I think, that is crucial is, God knows I can remember waking up, you know, morning after morning after morning after morning, feeling hungover and thinking, I don't want to do this anymore. But that is different from saying what I do want. It's you know, and it might be just the flip. I want to feel energy in the morning. I want to feel clear in the morning. I want to feel healthy. So why? Because I want to live a long time. Why? Because I've got so much to do. Why? Because I want to learn. Why? Because, and it's blah, 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 blah. And suddenly you get to something which can be very, very motivating. It's better when it isn't the motivation of the negative, I can't do this anymore. That may well be the tipping point, but to frame it into something you're committing to. What was yours? Your role modeling, yeah, being a good dad.
Yeah, yeah, role definitely setting that example.
Yeah,
lots of the dads that I coach, obviously they relate to my content and stuff I put out on social media, and they come to me, and then I'll be coaching them, and we'll dig into their why, and a lot of it obviously revolves around their kids. Examples could have been, you know, I was chatting to a dad the other day, and he was saying his daughter filmed him when he was drunk. You know, that's a real big one. So we're constantly tapping back into that why, you know, when those cravings, when those urges kick in. But you do need a really, really big why.
And you do.
So many people who white knuckle it through Dry January or do it for other reasons, it's never going to last. You have got to want change, as you know yourself.
Yeah, well, the reason why the why needs to be so powerful is it's where your courage comes from. You know, because we've talked and I've talked recently on this podcast about, you know, fear. And clearly, as soon as you get this resistance, it's fear, as you said earlier, it's fear of change. And, you know, there's this sort of sense, isn't there? Well, you have to overcome it. You have to move forward, but the why, if it's powerful enough, gives you the courage to do it. It sort of trumps the resistance that you might feel. I know when we were speaking before, I mentioned the sort of the Dan Sullivan model. He calls the it's four. It's the commitment.
Oh, four, sorry.
Yeah, no, the one I love is the one that comes at the end, which everyone thinks should come at the beginning. So it goes, you know, commitment. If you've got a strong enough commitment to something, then that is what gives you the tailwind. That is what gives you the nudge and the courage. And then as soon as you kind of go, in your case, it might have been something as simple as, I'm going to go up to Twickenham and not drink for the day in the safety of my family as opposed to with all my mates, and just see how that goes. But that's, you know, the courage to do that. And then you kind of go, oh my God, that was actually really bloody good. I could do that again. Then you get the competency. So it's commitment breeds courage. And the doing, the courage breeds the competency, the proof that you can, and then comes the confidence. But if we sat around waiting for confidence to be the start point, then we'd be waiting a very, very long time if you think about all the things you'd never have started if confidence was the prerequisite, right? So
yeah,
I do, exactly. I literally, for anyone listening to this who's kind of sitting there going, yeah, but it's not that easy, and you know, it's scary, it's like, yes it is. However, if you really feel that you, and this is, I know this is going to sound a bit controversial, but if you really don't feel compelled to move through with courage, then it's because you possibly haven't delved into your why and given yourself the highest level motivation to shoot for. Do you think that's fair, or do you think I'm oversimplifying things?
No, it's a really good point. And another thing, talking of confidence, Anna, as well, so many of people I speak to around booze is the reason why they drink is because it makes them feel confident. And it's so frustrating, isn't it? It's like, yeah, but it's just fake confidence. It's actually making you less and less confident because you can't go to a social event without drinking.
Yeah.
So many people I speak to, they go to a social event and they say, right, I'm not going to drink. I'm going to drink alcohol-free lager. I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. And then they get there and straight away they panic. Oh my God, I need a drink. And they go to the bar on autopilot and they'll get a beer, and then straight away it's that social crutch, isn't it? You know, having that drink in your hand, straight away, oh, they can breathe, they can relax, they can fit back into the group. And like you said, yeah, it's all about courage, but it's all about building that, you know, it's having enough courage to put your head above the parapet, to step out of your comfort zone. But you're never going to get there without taking that first step.
No, so, absolutely. And yeah, that might be that, you know, that for some people that might therefore be, you know, that worst fear of walking into a crowded room and, you know, socializing and needing that social confidence. It might just have to be that once, when by the end of the evening, the proof is there, you know, the competency is clear, you can do it. But it's kind of, I mean, there's been so much written about this kind of stuff. I mean, the sort of, I always remember reading somewhere that, you know, it sort of showed up for me that sort of fear or resistance, which is obviously a sort of a really invisible force, but it basically resistance is sort of equates to fear. It's not proof that something's impossible. It's just proof that it isn't familiar to you. So it's that sort of comfort zone thing again. So actually, one way of reinterpreting that fear is not, I can't do this. It's actually, I am doing this. I'm on the edge of doing something really bloody meaningful and smart, because if I wasn't, I wouldn't be feeling the resistance. It's actually a sort of, you know, you can see it as a positive sign. And I think, you know, Susan Jeff has made a bloody good book out of talking about feeling the fear and doing it anyway, you know, because it's when you push yourself outside of your comfort zone. And we say this in coaching circles all the time, that the sort of, you know, the magic happens. It doesn't, you know, fear doesn't mean that you can't do something. It just means you haven't done it yet. And it's, you know, it doesn't have to be grand sweeping change. It can be exactly what you did, Luke, which is just, you know, a trip to Twickenham here, or you think to yourself, what's the worst that could happen? I'm going to go out for the evening and I'm not going to. So what's the worst that could happen? Goodness me. You know?
Yeah. It's chunking it down, isn't it? It's creating those small steps. I'll always say to people that don't be overwhelmed. Don't think this is it. You're never going to drink again. You know, try a month, then try, if that goes well, then try 3 months, then 6 months, chunk it down. So many people get overwhelmed, don't they? And they really think, oh my God, I'm literally, my life's revolved around alcohol for decades. If I stop doing it, my whole life's going to change and this and that. You can do it in small incremental steps. And so many people relapse as well. And, you know, they'll have a drink and then they'll be like, oh my God, wow. No, it wasn't what I thought it was going to be. And they'll learn so much from that. Mm. People are so afraid of failure, aren't they? and you've got to learn to fail forward. You've got to, you know, you don't learn anything for when you succeed. I used to box. Growing up, I was a boxer, and my coach, every fight that I won, my coach always used to say, "You haven't learned anything from that." And every loss, he was always saying, "Don't think of it as a loss. Think of it as a learning curve." And it ties into so many other things in our life, doesn't it? And I think so many people are just so scared of change and fear of failing.
Well, yeah,
it's a massive thing, Anna.
It is, and I think a lot of it is to do with the fact that for so long the narrative around drinking has been around, you know, sort of absolutes. It's a sort of an all or nothing type thing, and if you push it too far, then you're an alcoholic, and it's, you know, it's an absolute type. You like to box things. I mean, you like to have it all neat and tidy. Whereas I think, you know what, thousands and thousands of people are finding these days is it's much more nuanced than that. You know, you can be a drinker and then go to the rugby one day and not drink. Doesn't mean you're never going to drink again. Just means that you didn't go to the rugby and drink that day. Doesn't mean anything. Doesn't define you. Doesn't sort of set you on a new permanent course from which there's no kind of comeback. It's just go and see what it's like. And if you like it, do it again. You know, and if you don't like it, question, well, what didn't I like about the day? And, you know, what jobs am I therefore kind of delegating to alcohol such that if it's not in my day, I don't enjoy myself? Why? How's that working? And just get curious about it, you know? Because I think what you did was fantastic. I think it was that sort of sense of I've woken up one morning, I don't like where my life is. I don't like who I've become. It starts with my parenting, but it's more than that. I want the next 40 years to look different. I don't want this for myself and for my kids. So what do I start doing about it? And it wasn't as I say, I like the fact that it wasn't even like, I must give up alcohol. It was more a case of how do I develop and grow into a different, you know, a different half of my life that just makes me feel better, you know, about myself and better about myself as a father. What did you learn? What you know, when you sort of say, oh, you learn so much about yourself and stuff like that, I just wanted to sort of quickly touch on what's the sort of most interesting thing that you found out about yourself, or what has surprised you most about yourself now that alcohol isn't part of the picture?
I think you touched on it earlier. I think we build up such a belief that we're not going to learn anything, and once we leave school and we get a job, then that's it, you know. Society teaches us that, doesn't it? But having gone through all this stuff, and obviously what we learn at school, we're taught that's it. But if you can go you can even go back to school if you want. You can go back to university, or you can do all these online courses. There's so much, you know, and when you grow and when you evolve, I feel so alive. I've got so much energy, and I'm choosing what I'm learning as well, Anna, and I know that by investing in myself, it's the ripple effect. It's what it's going to do for my kids, for my family, for all my clients. It's a massive, massive thing. And that's where I was, you know, going back to being happy, and where happiness comes from. That's where the fulfillment comes from. So just knowing you can learn, and you can literally change your life. You know, when you get to that point, that rock bottom or wherever it might be, just knowing that you can change, you can flip the script, and things are not set in stone. It's a massive thing for me. Growth has been transformational. And going back to NLP again, one of the first things I do with my clients is we break down their values. And lots of people that I speak to, they don't even know what their values are. They don't know what's important and what gives them meaning. And when you break those down, one of my values, my top six values, is growth. Because I think it's so detrimental to me. So yeah, that's a long-winded way of answering that. Sorry, but
no, it's good.
But growth, because it's giving me a new lease of life, Anna. It really has.
No, that's brilliant. I can tell just talking to you. I mean, you're very passionate. I'm very excited. It's almost like you're really excited about what's coming up, which is brilliant. Yeah. is that the greatest difference, do you think? The sort of the sense between, you know, who you were, the man you were then and the man you are now. Is it about that sort of, you know, optimistic positivity, bring it on sort of excitement?
Yeah, 100%. I never had a victim mindset. I don't think I was ever really, you know, grumpy and down in the dumps, but alcohol is a depressant, isn't it? So I was definitely more like that. But now I've definitely got more of a growth mindset rather than a fixed mindset. So yeah, I'm so much more positive, and obviously without the drinking, I try to think back to what I was like when I was drinking. Well, I couldn't even remember going to bed half of the time, but now when I go to bed and I go through my nightly routine, I'm excited to get up in the morning because I've got such a lovely routine. I get up early, I go out running, I exercise, meditation, journaling. You know, I love it. So yeah, things have changed massively for me in the last few years, definitely.
And I think it's worth pointing out quickly as well that, you know, I think it's an incredible, I mean, I can't overstress this. It is an incredibly valuable exercise to sit down and ask yourself, even if you don't think that your drinking is terribly bad, and even if you don't think you're anywhere remotely near, you know, your own version of a rock bottom, it's like, is my life good enough? You know, particularly when you get to those kind of birthdays, those 30s, 40s, 50s, you know, those kind of pivotal moments when you sort of somehow reflection seems to come in, and you just, they're a bit of a moment to sort of pause, aren't they? And, you know, I used to sort of just stick my head in the sand, but actually it's much healthier just to kind of not stick your head in the sand and just to do a little bit of an audit of, are you where you wanted to be? Is this what you envisaged when you were excited about life, age sort of 18? Is this, are you where you are? Are you where you wanted to be? Are you the person you wanted to be? And even little micro questions like, when was the last time you learnt something, like truly learnt something you didn't know, went out of your way to learn it, you know, and that kind of thing makes you go, bloody hell. Yeah, because I wasn't doing anything new. I wasn't exposing myself to any new stimuli. I wasn't, and as you know, my world was just getting smaller and smaller and more boring. And just, I thought I was having a laugh. It was literally, you know, looking back now, it was very, very one-dimensional and stagnant. It really was.
Yeah, yeah, and it's that one decision, isn't it? It's just one decision, I know, but it's a big one, but it feeds into everything, doesn't it?
It does.
And yeah, going back to what you just said, it's not settling, I think, you know,
it's
so many
not
people
settling.
They settle for that life, and then they wonder why they're miserable, they wonder why they argue with their partner, they wonder why this, that, and the other, and it feeds into every aspect of their life, but that one decision, Anna, yeah.
But it takes that sort of radical honesty, doesn't it, that you have to sort of, as I said, it can start with an abject hangover. It can start with feeling like you're going to puke up and you just don't want to keep doing this. But certainly, you know, it can sort of just twist it into, you know, this isn't good enough. It's not good enough. One life, and I'm spending
exactly.
it like this.
Exactly. We don't get that long here, do we?
Exactly. So just quickly then. You obviously, as a coach now, you focus. I know it's not exclusive, but you sort of, you talk to dads, and you've obviously got a great personal story that gives you great insight. The themes that come up often, I'm assuming, are the themes that you're, yep, I was there, mate. I got that too. Yep. The peer pressure, the sort of sense of assumed behavior, the pressure, stereotypes, all that sort of stuff comes up.
Like you said, is the big thing, it's the social settings, and it's letting go of that old identity. It's what their future looks like as well. It's the unknown, and it really scares the hell out of us, doesn't it? You were saying earlier on about the brain and familiarity, being in familiar surroundings all the time, and I think as human beings, sometimes we'd rather just stay in what we know is familiar rather than opening the door and actually seeing, you know, what could be on the other side. It scares the hell out of us. So many men that I speak to, yeah, they're just scared. They don't want to look behind the curtain. They don't want to open that door. And And it, you know, it's my job as a coach through my content and through helping clients to give them and help them have the courage, like you were saying before, to give it a go. I mean, what have they got to lose? You know, just give it a go.
To what degree, I'm just thinking about this as we're talking now, to what degree do you tend to find that guys particularly, is me stereotyping now, guys particularly don't want to be coached into any of that emotional sort of shit? You know, that, you know, like, or blokes don't talk about, you know, you're making yourself a bit vulnerable, aren't you, when you're sort of starting to talk about your pressures and your worries and your stuff like that. So do you come up against that dynamic to a certain degree as well?
Yeah, all the time. Blokes don't like talking. And the thing is, Anna, as well.
So you're just trying to build a career here talking to blokes about
that. That they want to
talk. Important. It's so important.
It's so important. So again, like with my children, it's being that role model and proving to them that they can have a decent life. Well, they can have an amazing life on the other side of alcohol. They're so stuck in those habits. And like I said earlier, whenever I speak to my friends about it, different people, the first thing they'll say is, oh yeah, okay, let's go down the pub and have a chat about it. And then they get in the pub, you know, they let their guard down, they have a drink, and then we're back on that vicious circle. So yeah, it's leading by example, really. And one of the things as well, Anna, that I just want to mention is it's been really, really tough for me not to be so self-righteous as well, to be a preacher, to stand up on your box and, you know, shout, because you want to, because when you go for this sort of transformation that I have, you want to tell everyone. It never goes down very well. And so my wife is always, in the beginning of my sobriety, she was always telling me, Luke, you've got to rein it in.
Put a lid on it, Luke.
You're coming across very, you know, self-righteous. So now when we go out this year in the summer, we went away with a group of friends, and I didn't mention being a sober coach once. I really, really held it back, and we had a great time, and it wasn't mentioned once. But going back a few holidays ago, I remember going away with people and trying to tell them, it's like, mate, all you've got to do is give up this one thing and you can have an amazing life, blah, 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 blah. But people aren't ready, are they? So
no, you're not going to get invited back.
No one likes a self-righteous prick.
I spent a lot of my sort of early months of not drinking, just wishing, you know, I'd say to people, you do you, and I'll do me. So now I have to kind of honor them as well. And I think, well, let them be them and I'll just be me. And I don't have to shove my world down their throats, and they don't have to shove their worlds down my throats, and that's fine. But if you could put one message in the ear of any man, I am going to say man, because it's, you know, we're talking about that niche, as it were, at the moment. If you could put any message in the ear of a man who's resisting change because of a sense of fear tonight, what would you say?
I would say reach out for support. So you were saying before about vulnerability. So when we are vulnerable, I really truly believe that is when we really connect. So, you know, who you surround yourself with is a massive thing, isn't it? You know, the sixth person of the five people you surround yourself with. If you're going to continue to go to the pub and be surrounded by people who drink, then there's a very good chance you're going to continue to drink. Social media gets such a bad rap, but I think there's so much good stuff on social media, especially around sobriety. There's so many good groups on you know, social media groups, Facebook groups. You know, get an accountability partner. Start surrounding yourself with people who have gone sober and who are reaping the benefits. Because that's going to be such an important thing. And like I was saying before, we're tribal creatures. And if you surround yourself with like-minded people, Anna, it's a massive, massive thing. And that's when most men that I speak to do open up and they start, you know, coming across to and actually believing that a life of sobriety is something that they could have.
Yeah. And I the other thing that I always find astonishing is quite often when somebody sort of makes a commitment and has the courage to be the first. It is unbelievable how many people in a group turn around and go, oh my God, yeah, I've been feeling this way for ages, or I'm drinking too much too, actually. And then it's possible to kind of find your wingman, you know, if we're sort of saying, oh, we're tribal creatures by nature, and, you know, being cast out is our greatest fear, having a wingman, you know, or an accountability partner or someone is just the most important thing. It genuinely is.
Yeah, it's massive. An addiction is a very, you can isolate yourself, can't you? Especially when you're drinking on your own, of course, you know, and you can really dig yourself into a massive hole.
Oh, you can. You can.
So, yeah, if you join the right groups and you get an accountability partner, it can be really transformational, definitely.
Of course. And obviously people can get in touch with you as well. I'm going to put your details in the show notes. But
thank you.
This has been such an interesting conversation, Luke. I've really enjoyed it. I knew I would, but I have. I've really, really enjoyed it. And I hope that the conversation has also demonstrated to anyone listening that, you know, resistance is bloody natural. Fear is overcomable, and the sort of the most, I suppose, powerful way of moving through the resistance and sort of feeling the fear is to have a very, very strong reason, a very, very strong, motivating, highly emotional, highly compelling, non-negotiable why. Why do I want to do this? Make it positive, make it, you know, entirely empowering, the person you want to be, the thing you want to be. And that's the crucial piece of it, isn't it? If you're going to feel the fear, it's natural. If you want to get through it, then have a real think about what that why is, because that's what's going to give you the tailwind and the courage.
In those dark times, which inevitably they will come.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah, you need to be ready. Yeah.
Absolutely. Brilliant. Okay. Thank you so much for joining me, Luke. I really appreciate it. I'm sure this conversation has been helpful to a huge number of people. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Anna. Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening and getting curious. Please rate, review and follow this podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you're choosing to listen. And don't forget to tune in to the next episode. And you can find out more about the Big Drink Rethink by heading to my website, thebeliefscoach.com. That's thebeliefs, BELIEFS, coach.com, where you will see clear links to the show.